music of the medieval mystic Hildegard von Bingen. And I'll be saying a few words about her shortly. My approach to this question is going to be rather different to what we've just heard from Imam Afros, and it will be very interesting to see how this takes our discussion into the topic more widely. So here's a little bit of a map, if you like, of some of the people that we will be looking at this afternoon. I put Al-Ghazali there because he's obviously an important figure in the with relation to the Al-Ghazali Center. Hildegard von Bingen, Rumi, Meister Eckhart, Hadovich of Antwerp, that Jennifer will be speaking about, the Cloud of Unknowing, and St. John of the Cross. Now, I'm not going to deal with all of these, but this is creating a context where we can see the Christian and the Islamic mystics who all in some way address this theme of love and intellect as a recipe for peace. Hildegard von Bingen, I include her because she has quite an eccentric way of approaching the divine, or so it seems. She's been referred to as an ecstatic mystic. She was a Benedictine abbess born in Germany around 1098, and she found her connection to the divine through music and song, some of which we've been listening to. Her mystical experience was mediated through visions which confirmed for her a connection to the divine. At the age of 42, she received a vision that she believed was a direct instruction from God to write down that which you see and hear. And she was in fact given papal support for these visions. Here, for example, she talks about this. "When I was 42 years and 7 months old, heaven was opened and a fiery light of exceeding brilliance came and permeated my whole brain and inflamed my whole heart and my whole breast. Not like a burning, but like a warming flame, as the sun warms anything its rays touch." Now, she speaks very much using the language of fire and light, and I can see a strong connection here actually with the tradition of Rumi, which we'll come to shortly. She also speaks, "I, the fiery life of divine essence, am a flame beyond the beauty of the meadows. I gleam in the waters and I burn in the sun, moon and stars. I awaken everything to life." Well, song and music and the translation of her experience into words was clearly very important to her whole spirituality. It's interesting to, and incidentally, that's an image, one of her many paintings that she did there on the bottom right-hand corner of the screen. Very mandalic. If we contrast her... Somebody, yeah. If we contrast her way of thinking about the sacred in life with Rumi, we've got a very interesting question. Both Hildegard von Bingen and Rumi are, of course, deeply concerned with finding the roots of peace, something that's part of our season now, surely. Most of you know, no doubt, the hymn by Charles Wesley, "Peace on Earth and Mercy Mild, God and Sinners Reconciled." So how to reach that peace? What is required? Hildegard of Bingen, she has these ecstatic visions which give her a sense of inner completion and connection with her community. Rumi says this, and I'm sure this is not the whole of Rumi, but this particular quotation struck me as having something really central to say about our theme today. "If your knowledge of fire comes only from words, ask to be cooked. Do not dwell in the certainty acquired through others. There is no real certainty before burning. You want this certainty? then enter fire. And this raises a very interesting question for me about the connection between spiritual experience and language. And a number of the people that I'm going to be speaking about in the next 30 minutes or so see language and the use of intellect that is separated from the whole person as something that can distort our connection with the truth. Rumi implies that far more than words are needed, that maybe words don't connect us deeply enough to a level of experience where knowledge can become truth. This is a theme that runs deeply through the Christian mystical tradition also. And it's often seen, the mystical tradition is often seen as a necessary counterbalance to the scholastic tradition, which rests so strongly on intellect and the use of reason. One of the shining lights in this area is the unknown author of a book that many people nowadays see as a very important introduction to ways of seeing, ways of truth that perhaps are missing in our own education system. The author of The Cloud of Unknowing. He was alive in the 13th century. And here is a quote from him that questions our need to understand intellectually. He's not advocating feeling, but he's implying that our ego is often in the way of our perception of truth. Our intense need to understand will always be a powerful stumbling block to our attempts to reach God in simple love, and must always be overcome. For if you do not overcome this need to understand, it will undermine your quest. It will replace the darkness which you have pierced to reach God with clear images of something which, however good, however beautiful, however godlike, is not God. Now, you know, from my own experience as a teacher and an academic for nearly 50 years, it's interesting that I reflect on my early days of acquiring knowledge. My field is literature, by the way, literature and poetry. I reflect on my early days where I thought the more information I would put into my head, the more I knew about all my authors, the more human I would become, the more intelligent I would become. And I have got, my wife is here, she'll attest to the fact that I've got a library as large as four people could never digest in a lifetime. So I've been undermined also by my greed for knowledge and my greed for filling my intellect with perceptions and understandings. Increasingly, I find that the words of this author and others, that truth is to be found not through increasing and enhancing our level of knowledge, but in fact letting go, in fact coming to a place where something much deeper is contacted, where we have not necessarily an emotional connection with truth, but a deeper sense of being, my being as a human being. And this is certainly where I'm coming from in the passages that I want to take you through in relation to this question. Recipe for peace. Is it through love or is it through the intellect? And then what is love? It's interesting that Imam Afroz spoke about a number of different types of love. What is love? Love is, my simplest way of understanding it, is an experience of wholeness, of connection to my life, appreciation and gratitude for my life here and now, and through that, an openness to what is around me and to other people around me. And that doesn't come for me through reasoning. That comes for me through letting go, and often through the works and the writings, particularly of the medieval mystics and beyond. 2 centuries after the Cloud of Unknowing, the Spanish mystic Saint John of the Cross, in the conclusion to his 7th letter, written in 1587 to the Discalced Carmelite nuns, wrote, "Our greatest need is to be silent before this great God with the appetite and the tongue. To be silent with the appetite and the tongue. For the only language he hears is the silent language of love." The silent language of love. Very mysterious, very poetic, what that can possibly mean. We always assume that love is somewhere out there, immediately in our interaction with other people, with other things. But here St. John of the Cross is giving quite a different flavour to this idea, that the language of love is deeply embedded in our silence, in our capacity for interiority. Earlier in the same letter he writes, "What is wanting," and this is to a group of nuns, "What is wanting, if anything is wanting, is not writing or speaking. Rather, these usually superabound, but silence and work. Furthermore, speaking distracts one, while silence and work recollects and strengthens the spirit. Never cease to quiet your heart with deep love so as to suffer whatever comes along." That's a very interesting idea. To quiet your heart with deep love, be deeply connected with your own inner experience, so that you can suffer whatever comes along. There's a kind of an image here of somehow that there's this multiplicity inside us, that we have other things going on, and that we need to suffer the totality of who we are. So love is not some kind of blissing out in some kind of euphoric connection with the cosmos. It's interesting to me how this is so different from Hildegard von Bingen. Hildegard von Bingen expresses herself, you know, through this visionary connection with fire and light, whereas St. John of the Cross seems to, in some way, go in quite a different direction. He finishes, "Keep this in mind, daughters. The soul that is quick to turn to speaking and conversing is slow to turn to God." You know, so the human being who's so gifted with language can often become his or her greatest enemy to a perception of the deepest truth. He wrote a whole book called Maxims on Love. And here is the first and the 21st, actually. "Bridle your tongue and your thoughts very much. Direct your affection habitually toward God, and your spirit will be divinely kindled." Well, again, I'm connecting this idea of a fire with Rumi. But what's interesting here is that he's talking about the need to direct our feeling toward God, and that will kindle something deeper than the feelings, the divine element in the human being. I think it's picked up in the next maxim. "The Father spoke one word, which was his Son, and this word he always speaks in eternal silence. And in silence must it be heard by the soul." So there is this deep thought in mystical Christianity that if one enters a deep meditative silence, then what you are connecting with is the deepest part of yourself, your being, but that being at its root is also the divine, Jesus, God. Name it what you will. William Blake, the great romantic author, who spent so much of his life painting and writing about the divine, using his interior imagination, actually declared, "The imagination is Jesus." For him, that was not a contradiction at all. Now, the next person I wish to look at is Meister Eckhart. Now, he lived the same time as Jalal ad-Din Rumi. He lived an extraordinarily active life outwardly. He was an administrator. He was a teacher. He was in charge of a monastery, and yet at the same time he was innerly contemplative. He spoke regularly to his community about contemplative practice, his famous table talks. He's a real champion. If people are thinking, I often think, you know, how can one possibly combine a life of such intense activity with interiority, with stillness? They seem to be mutually exclusive. Meister Eckhart proved that not to be so. He lived a life that was intensely contemplative and at the same time outwardly very active and committed to his community and to the society around. As was often the case with the Christian mystics, he was treated with suspicion by the church hierarchy for daring to suggest that the inner life was something deeply individual, connected with silence, connected with the inner world. It was a challenge to the hierarchy, as the mystical meditative tradition is. Those in charge always want to, as it were, keep control of the truth. They don't want people individually going off and discovering their own truth. My favourite sermon by Meister Eckhart is his sermon on detachment, in which he actually talks about love, but he actually sees love as contained by a deeper, more powerful virtue, and that is detachment. He says, I find, as well as my reason can testify or perceive, that only pure detachment surpasses all things. For all virtues have some regard to creatures, but detachment is free of all creatures. Creatures here, he's talking about activities in life. Therefore our Lord said to Martha, unum est necessarium, only necessary, which is as much as to say, Martha, he would be serene and pure, he who would be serene and pure needs but one thing, detachment. And if you're not familiar with the story in Luke where Jesus visits a house with the two sisters, Martha and Mary, Martha is the one who's running around getting the feast ready, hyperactive, and she sees her sister Mary just sitting at Jesus' feet, doing nothing. And she's very agitated and irritated by the fact that Mary can just sit there and do nothing. And the Lord says to Martha, he who would be serene and pure needs but one thing, detachment. He wasn't criticizing her, but he was pointing out to her that there was maybe a different way of being in different circumstances. Meister Eckhart continues in this same essay, sermon rather, the teachers greatly praise love, as does St. Paul, who says, whatever things I may do and have not love, I am nothing. But I extol detachment above love, any love, because at best love constrains me to love God, but detachment compels God to love me. God is bound to give himself to a detached heart. Now that means an awful lot to me. It means to me very much that as 20th century individuals, we're always wanting to get something, to find something, to achieve something. And in meditative practice particularly, we always are trying to reach something, to take something, to find something, to achieve a connection with the divine. But in fact, I learn, that the only way towards a deeper connection is to let go of all that part of me that wants to hold on. The ego that drives me to wish to connect. Do we have the intelligence? And here intelligence does come in clearly. Do we have the intelligence to let our striving let go? Can we let that go, and can we come to something that is free from attachment? It's a beautiful sermon. I can recommend it to everybody. It's about 5 pages long. Wonderful sermon. Well, what prevents us from being open to such an approach from the divine? And I just had to choose this poem. It's one of my most favourite poems by George Herbert. I teach this in my literature classes. George Herbert was an Anglican priest who lived at the time of Shakespeare. born just towards the end of Shakespeare's life in Wales. He wrote deeply personal lyrical poetry about his inner life, especially his relationship to God. And in his poems, he wrote little mini dramas that capture the universal experience of our quest for connection with the ineffable. And George Herbert saw in himself so many things that stood in the way of his connection with the divine. Fear, guilt, worrying about what other people think. And so in this poem, George Herbert, through this mini drama, where he is actually addressed by love, and love here becomes, as we see, ultimately the embodiment of God, the embodiment even of Jesus. Addressed by love, he resists, he closes off, he can't relate. So much in him is inhibiting that relationship. But eventually, something in him lets go, and he finds himself embraced by the experience. Let me read the poem. Love bade me welcome, yet my soul drew back, guilty of dust and sin. But quick-eyed love, observing me grow slack from my first entrance in, drew nearer to me, sweetly questioning if I lacked anything. A guest, I answered, worthy to be here. Love said, you shall be he. I, the unkind, the ungrateful, ah, my dear, I cannot look on thee. Love took my hand and smiling did reply, who made the eyes but I? Truth, Lord, but I have marred them. Let my shame go where it doth deserve. And know you not, says love, who bore the blame? My dear, then I will serve. You must sit down, says love, and taste my meat. So I did sit and eat. So the poem climaxes with this Eucharistic Christ offering his flesh to the persona, and the persona finally accepting the invitation of the beginning and consuming it. It's a mystical, mysterious moment of intimacy in which love actually enters the persona. And the persona experiences love not merely by sight or by hearing or by feeling or smelling, but by actually tasting it, ingesting it, taking it into his own body. He becomes the body of Christ, and love dwells within him. One of the contemporary carriers of these ideas, of this mystical tradition that connects us deeply with the truth, love at our hearts, is Lawrence Freeman. And I've just been recently spending time at a conference that he has had in Sydney, and I was deeply impressed by the way that he spoke about the need to find love deeply within our own inner experience, free from the distractions of the world. He's written a long essay called Aspects of Love, and with this conference in mind, I had to go there and see how he actually spoke about this. And he's drawn a lot of his thoughts from the ancient desert fathers, the tradition of the Philokalia, the tradition of Christian mysticism, but he's also very open to other religious traditions. He writes, in the stillness of meditation, we let go of our fixed ideas, judgments and prejudices, which imprison us in our relationship with ourselves, with others, and with God. And I can see that sentence chiming very strongly with what Imam Afros Ali said, how it's our judgments, our prejudices, that whole paraphernalia of our outward relationship to the world that closes us off, imprisons us. He continues, in stillness comes a knowledge of the Spirit, which enables us to experience life free from all conceptual reference to levels of reality. So the emphasis here, as in Meister Eckhart, as in St. John of the Cross, is that in stillness there comes a different kind of knowledge that leads us to experience. Now this, I think, is the key word for me, an embodied experience of spirituality, not just something that feeds the intellect. He continues, when we meditate, we transcend and move beyond the limitations of our own desires and fears, of our ego, of our individuality. We break out of the culture-bound understanding of love only as an erotic, egotistical force that leads to disappointment when it fails or dies. We break out of that into a vision of love that is of God, a vision of love we find in the New Testament, a vision of love that enables us incredibly to equate God and love. God is love. And it's one thing to say those words, try and understand it intellectually. It's another thing to have some experience of an interior silence where you touch something that is beyond your own intellectual fabrications and connects you with an experience of wholeness of being. And this is the last slide that I will show. I've just been given my warning time. But this seems to strike to the heart of today's theme, love and intellect, recipe for peace. What is the recipe for peace? Well, Lawrence Freeman says to meditate is to become a student of love. The experience of love to which meditation leads us renews our religious understanding and our spiritual vision. We come to be able to see how deeply love is the background energy of everything we are and everything we do. It is the ultimate meaning of all our experience. Now, how to understand that? You know, I know for myself that quite often in the day I can be chaotic. I can be all over the place. I can be reactive to this person and that person. I can hate this person for that. I can enjoy this person for that. I can have my head filled with all sorts of ideas, past, present, and future. And that's the way many of us live our lives. And yet I can then come to a meditation and have a totally different experience of myself, where all those things that I've reacted in the day are just chatter and are seen for their lack of substance, their hollowness. So where does that intelligence come from? And at the same time, I feel a great gratitude for my life here and now today. Where does that intelligence come from? I can even turn with love to things around me much more than I could before. Where does that intelligence come from? So just to complete, finish off there, Lawrence Freeman, who I'm just making a little promotion here, is actually going to be standing where I am next July. We've invited him here to take part in a conference that's called Awakening the Sacred Through Literature and the Arts. And he will be here for that. So thank you all. It's now time for afternoon tea. So we'll be back here in half an hour. Please make yourself at home. I don't know if the afternoon tea's arrived yet. What time is it supposed to arrive? It's supposed to arrive in 10 minutes. So please go and take fresh air for 10 minutes and then enjoy your afternoon tea. Went. last at the time.
Oh my gosh, I thought that I was just doing sort of 20 minutes and.
You didn't read the email. But you can read it backwards when you get to the.
Last time.
Yeah.
The afternoon is 3:42, 4:10, right? I think that's the right time. Is that on the right?
No. Yeah,
that's wrong, is it? What is it?
I was actually going to say to you before you started that it would have taken me extra 10 minutes.
Yeah, don't worry, it's all right.
It's okay.
And I'm sure as we move along, there'll be some times here and there.
I will.
And also international guests.
My apologies. My paper is much shorter, so nobody has to even worry.
No, we'll have plenty of time for technical conversation.
I misread my Insta.
Plus, there'll be plenty of time for conversation as well.
Yeah, so
okay.
It was 3:40 to 4:10.
I'll change that. 3:40 to 4:10. Good.